accession number 18577, Reel 2.
Barclay Meredith, Reel 2.
Now remember thinking as the band set off, well, I wonder what Hitler would do to this lot today. But it was a very good parade, and I suppose it was good for discipline.
So this is 1942, presumably?
Yes, it would be, yeah.
What happened next?
I think I was with the Lancashire Fusiliers for about 18 months. In the event, the regiment was disbanded. In fact, I think the whole brigade was disbanded. I can't be sure about that. And we were all sent to different regiments. Prior to being sent off, a unit from the parachute regiment came to recruit volunteers for the parachute regiment. I had no particular desire to join them, but several of my friends decided they'd see what it was all about, and there was no obligation apparently, so I joined them. As we were having our medicals, though, one by one, as they came from the medical, one was rejected for flat feet, another one was rejected for bad teeth, all sorts of ridiculous things. So I thought, well, I don't particularly want to go now. But anyway, I was rejected too because I was too light. They said, you won't come down, you'll go up if you jump. So that was that. I was a bit relieved, really, because I didn't really want to join them. So we all had a leave. We were given 7 days leave. I think it was about the second leave I'd had. I think we were 1 weekend at the end of our training from Bovington. So this was a big thing to go on 7 days leave. But I think I'd been home about 3 days, and I got a telegram to recall to join a parachute training regiment somewhere up in Manchester. The training there was very hard, actually.
With the paras?
Pardon?
With the parachute regiment?
With the paras, yeah. You had to be very fit. And I suppose we were all fit then, because from day one of basic training, you had PT every day, and I think we were fit. You had to be particularly fit in this unit. Every day there was a forced march. I can't remember the exact time or distance, but it was probably something like about 7 miles, and it had to be done in under the hour, and the forced march was to run so many paces, and then a quick march for so many paces, but with full pack. If you dropped out on the way, then you were RTU, and that was that. I used to collapse once we got back in the gates, so I wasn't RTU. But I did realise that I wasn't the sort of stuff that would make a good paratrooper. The training instilled you with confidence, tremendous confidence. You had sort of light drops from a platform in an aircraft hangar. You also graduated to, in the aircraft hangar, there was a ladder you scaled up the wall, and a shelf going along one side of it with a clip on a harness which you attached to your harness. And you jumped from this platform to the ground below onto a padded mat. And the thing that broke your fall was a small, I'm not sure whether it was 2 or 3 bladed fan which whirred around as you went round. But it broke your fall. Then you graduated to to a jump from a tower. As I say, you learn to fall, how to roll when you fell, and you're very, very fit. The final effort was not a jump from a plane, but from a balloon, which was like a barrage balloon, and a basket underneath. I've never told anybody this before, so I'm not sure how happy I'm about saying it now, because I was okay once we were in the basket and up, and the instructor was giving instructions to jump. So we'll have a sing song on the way up. And he chose something which evoked childhood memories. And I knew how upset my mother had been when I was joining this paratrooper regiment. And it did something to me, and I thought, I can't go through with this. And so I was RTU'd. I'm not sorry I was, but it was probably the most devastating feeling I've ever had in my life. The fact that it was something I could have done, and I didn't do it, and to that extent I'd failed myself, and I'd failed people around me. And I don't think I've ever forgotten that feeling. But I haven't been able to tell anybody else about it. But it is part of, it's part of me, and it's part of what happened then. I think it's a good thing that I did go back to, I didn't join them, because I don't think I could ever have been a sufficiently positive person to have successfully engaged in one-to-one combat. When we were doing our basic training, as everybody did, you had a rifle with a bayonet, you had bayonet drill, and I, at that time, used to think, I don't think I could ever do this. If it came to it, I don't think I could do it. And I still, to this day, doubt if I could have done it.
Sticking a bayonet into somebody.
Yeah, yes, one-to-one combat, and actually doing that sort of thing. I think if we go back to childhood again, I was a choir boy and I belonged to a church, and my parents weren't religious and I wasn't particularly religious, but I did belong to a church. Being a choir boy, it meant one times three services a day, so you listen to boring sermons, you hear the same ritual, you have the same Ten Commandments. But I think it has an effect on you. It becomes part of what your beliefs are. And when you think of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, it's difficult to come to terms with that. There are times when you've got to, obviously. And maybe in self-defense one would do it, but I had doubts about myself. So that was that very brief sojourn, but as a training I enjoyed it. And I don't think I've ever been fitter.
So, obviously, you couldn't be returned to the first six Lancashire for years, did they didn't exist?
No, they didn't exist. So this is when I went to Catterick in Yorkshire, near Richmond, and it was both a base where they trained people, and where they sent people off to other places. It was there that I only ever met two of the people who had been with me at Bovington, and they were both by that time commissioned. They were both second lieutenants, and one was called Wally Ward, and the other was called Chris Willicott. And they were two of the nicest lads you could have met. They were the only two people I ever met after I left Bovington that I'd met at Bovington. So from there I went on to the Staffordshire Yeomanry. And I joined them it must have been down south somewhere. Where exactly I can't remember. But the Staffordshire Yeomanry had come back from the desert. Can I tell you something about the Staffordshire Yeomanry? At that time I knew nothing about them, but I think I was very, very lucky to join them. They'd been, when war broke out, they were a territorial regiment, and believe it or not, they were on an exercise in Syria. So that when war broke out, they were in Syria. And their first battle honour was won in Syria, around about that time. And do you know who they were fighting? They were fighting the French. I hadn't realised that until I read the regimental history some months ago. But from that day on, they remained in the desert all the time. So they were desert rats, 7th Armoured Division, and they were at Alamein and all the previous battles, Tunisia, Tripoli, the lot. So they were very, very battle hardened. Some of them have been up through Italy, etc. And it was then when they came home to take part in what was then called the Second Front that I joined them. So a very battle hardened regiment. And there must have been a very different type of comradeship in a regiment like that to, not a different comradeship, a different relationship between the different ranks in a regiment like that and a regular regiment. I'm not saying that discipline was any the less, but I think there was a different spirit, because when you think back, a lot of these people had known each other in Civvy Street. They were in maybe different walks of life, but they had to live with each other, not only in their service commitment, but also as civilians. So I think there was a more relaxed atmosphere between the various ranks in a regiment like that than there could ever have been in a regular regiment. If you were a regular soldier, you'd join the army as a soldier professionally, and your interest would have been to get on and for promotion. You'd have wanted to be a senior non-commissioned officer or to have been a commissioned officer. I don't think the same competition, the competition didn't exist to the same degree in a regiment. It was a territorial regiment. I never realised or experienced anything such as class distinction whilst I was in the army. And when a couple of years ago, somebody who to whom I was speaking, I joined a provost club in Tavistock, and a lot of the members near to the coast, ex-navy, ex-army, and they were mainly fairly high-ranking people, some of them. And the chap to whom I was speaking said, "Marky, there's a lot of class consciousness amongst this lot, isn't there?" And I hope nobody from Tavistock of Provis is going to hear this. That's why I don't think so. I've never found it. But little things tend to emerge. I beg your pardon. Little things tend to emerge which you don't always notice when people are all talking about perhaps the mess, and they don't mean the sergeant's mess, or the private's mess. They mean the mess where if you sat above the sort, then it was fine. If you sat below the sort, it may not have been so fine. And I hadn't honestly realised that this existed, but it still does exist to this day, I suppose, because having sort of traced my old comrades' association round about 1992, I've never regrettably been able to get to any of their functions, but there's an old comrades' dinner. But there's a separate dinner for commissioned officers. And sometimes when you see parades such as Armistice, and I've got Armistice parades, and it goes way back, and it still exists. I've got a picture of my father marching past the cenotaph in the 1920s. The officers would bowler hats and their umbrellas, which to me in this day and age seems ludicrous, but I think that regimental tradition must still exist. I'm sorry in part that I maybe didn't experience it, because it would have been something to have been experienced.
And were the Savage Yeomanry equipped with Churchills when you joined them?
No, they had Shermans.
What did you think of them?
I thought they were great, obviously, because they were new, and the equipment that came with them was super. We all had a little torch that would hang onto your waistband, if you liked, and everything was pristine and far more upmarket than the sort of equipment we've been used to. But they still got a small gun. They were 6-pounders. They were a pretty fast tank, relatively. I think they would... Memory gets a bit dim. I think they would go up to about 30 miles an hour. What we didn't realise, though, was the difference in the armour plating on a Mark IV Sherman as compared with even the Mark IV German tanks, which were a tremendously good tank. But then I think we'd have shuddered a lot more had we realised the armour on the Tigers and the Panthers.
And were you mainly as operating as a wireless operator?
Yes, yeah. We had a crew of 5 in a Sherman. Commander, operator, who also acted as a loader, gunner, driver and co-driver. Sometimes we only had 4. But the co-driver normally could be shifted around. We could all have been shifted around because certainly I could have driven, I could have operated the arm. We could all have done different things.
Now, can you take me through the preparations for D-Day, please?
Yep. I joined the Staffordshire Yeoman. I can't remember where exactly. It was down south. But within days, weeks of joining them, we took our tanks, which were loaded onto what they call flats on the railway wagons, and we went up to Lossiemouth in Scotland. That was a long journey because I think it took about a couple of days or more, because we were shunted into sidings, obviously, for other traffic to go through. And we went up to Gordonstoun in not far from Lossiemouth, into that beautiful, beautiful Scottish countryside. So I can now proudly say, with the rest of my regiment, that we went to the same school as did Prince Philip and Prince Charles. That was quite good fun. It was winter, it was January 1944. And there was a lot of snow on the ground, but the days were crisp, and the sun shone, and the skies were blue, and it was wonderful. And from then on, we were in Nissen huts in the grounds of Gordonstoun College. And I think we had our mess hall in the college itself, which meant the main hall of the college was a beautiful place, a beautiful fireplace. I can remember it had been very badly treated. It had been treated as, it had been used as a hospital, and it had not been looked after, so it was a bit of a shame. That's where we did our training. It was miles and miles from anywhere. I didn't realise just how far it was from anywhere until recently we visited some Scottish friends and we did a nostalgia tour trying to find the beaches on which we did our training. There are lots of fine beaches up there, sandy beaches, flat coming from the sea, Lossiemouth itself, places like Burghead. I can't remember all the names. I never did find the beach that I could recognise that we did most of our training on. But it was a good trip.
What was the character of the training on the beach?
Our tanks had to be what we call waterproofed. All the plates which were underneath the tank had to be sealed. Anywhere where there could have been gaps of water in it had to be sealed. The exhaust had to have a fitting like a chute at the back, which came out at, and then up at right angles so that it stood vertically to take all the exhaust away so that no water got into the to the exhausts and engines. So it was a question of water sealing all your tanks and to go on to craft, to off-land, and to practice going on to beaches. As simple as that.
What was the approved method of going onto a beach?
You drove off the end of the ramp, hoped that there wasn't a big hole underneath you, and just sailed up the... drove up the beach, as simple as that. There weren't any obstacles which we had to avoid, as there would get subsequently going to be. This was really just purely practicing launching and landing. There's no gunnery training there, obviously. All that had been done for years before. It was a new technique for the staff yeoman, I'm quite sure. It was a new technique for everybody.
Was there any problem using the wireless in a Sherman?
No, I never found in any tank that the wireless communications could ever be terribly good. We had at that time what were called 19 sets. I'm not sure whether they're British or American. They were certainly fitted into the Shermans. And they were used for three things. Communicating between each other in the tank, because we all wore headsets, obviously, so that you could receive instructions from your tank commander. They were used for inter-troop and HQ communication. The aerials weren't terribly long, and you could extend your aerial, and then, of course, reception would have been better. But the fact was that if you had a bigger aerial, it meant that your transmission, apart from being able to hear from further afield, when you transmitted, you could also be heard from further afield. So there was a strict rule as to the amount of aerial you could use. To communicate, we used to do what we call netting the tanks, so that you had a frequency into which you had to tune, and all the tanks of a troop and the squadron would net on that frequency. And you would have to use a strict radio telephony procedure so far as codes were concerned. Quite much simplified in these days, but you'd call up if you were C squadron, Charlie 1, 2 and 3, perhaps for Troop 1, 2 and 3. Hello, Charlie 1, I report my signals. Charlie 1, over. Oh, hello, Charlie 2, receiving your signal strength, such and such. Charlie 2, over. Tremendous waste of time as compared with what would happen nowadays. And so you would net, and by turning a manually operated dial, which wasn't a very finely tuned dial, and having got your frequency netted with the other people, you would then tighten a screw on that dial so that the dial couldn't move. But if you can imagine a dial which turns, and it's on a pin or a pivot, as soon as you tighten that, something is going to happen to it. So there are lots of drawbacks to getting a good net. And whilst you were on a good net to start with, as soon as you moved away, very often the stations you're trying to reach would become fainter than you would have liked. I'm quite sure that on occasions some other people did put up a longer aerial, but to do that, you were risking having your positions mapped.
So you were in northeast Scotland doing this beach training. What happened next?
Well, not beach training. Right, well now, it must have been... We must have been there from January to until May. The exact dates of the movement I can't remember. We would have come down, say, sometime in May, maybe early May, down to Sussex. And we were camped there. And we were under canvas there. And I think we were in a camp somewhere near a place called Bolney. The pub was within walking distance, I know, because everybody would hear for the pub as soon as you got an opportunity. I think some people may have ventured further afield, particularly those who may have had relatives anywhere there. I think it may have been somewhere near Petworth, but I'm not sure of the grounds of the parkland into which we were actually camped.
What were you doing at Bolney?
Waiting. We're also being briefed. It was fairly obvious what was going to happen, and at what stage we became confined to these camps, and there was no entry to or from them, I can't remember. But I think it was probably no more than a week or 2 weeks before D-Day that this happened, probably nearer to a week, but I can't remember the time scale now. But there were mess tents there, naffy tents and all that sort of thing, so I think a lot of people did a lot of drinking. Eat, drink and be merry for tomorrow, who knows what. We were briefed meticulously. As to coastlines, maps which had no place names or anything like that on them, scale models, and I think you must have seen them probably on television during the lead up to the 50th anniversary commemorations of D-Day. Models of the whole of the coastal area, which was within the sector where you were expected to be landing. And tremendously well done. Montgomery addressed all his troops before D-Day because he believed in putting as people in the picture, as he put it. And he was a man who liked to be seen, and he was very well respected, because particularly in the sort of regiment I was with, because they were desert rats. And the detail of information, the quantity of information, and the elaborate detail was tremendous. The officers obviously have far more information than they did, because they were briefed more deeply, I suppose, but all the information was passed on to right the way through the whole command. Yes, you've got pictures of the beach you were going to land on. The house which you've got to aim for maybe as a landmark. That sort of thing. So mainly, yes, it was making.